Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Mindig. I am the host of the Behavior Health Integration Podcast. And today is episode number 5, Outpatient Treatment Facilities. So throughout the process of this episode, I'll be discussing the certain levels of care when it comes to outpatient treatment, what it actually entails, the process of getting into it, and the days that are actually required by clients to attend outpatient treatment. Now, again, I had the pleasure of actually starting my career working as a counselor at an outpatient treatment center, so I feel like I have a lot of good information to give regarding this. And again, this is just my lens through this, and this is just the one place I worked, because again, all treatment centers run their facilities a little bit differently. So I feel like I'm going to give everyone and all the listeners just good, solid, basic information on this. And again, if anyone ever has any questions about what I said or whatnot, please feel free to leave me a message. So I guess just to start off, I will be discussing how do people actually get an outpatient treatment, or what are their main motivations to doing so. Okay. Well, just to begin any process, you will be doing an assessment. Right now in Minnesota, we call it the Rule 25, which I do hear that we're going to be getting rid of soon, and we're just going to be doing basic comp assessments and summaries. Again, that's not right now, but that could be in the near future too. But for the sake of argument, we'll just go with the Rule 25. And for all the listeners that don't know what that is, it's just a substance abuse assessment, to keep it simple for everyone. So there's pretty much like 6 basic levels. You know, dimension 1 is like their actual drug use. Like, how often did they use a certain substance? What was the frequency of their use? How many days in the week did they use? How much did they use? And from a time perspective, have they been doing this type of behavior for 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years, and etc.? Just so the assessor knows like the severity again of their overall use, and again if they're using other drugs as well. So dimension 2 is more of their physical health too. Like, do they go to the hospital a lot? Are they currently on Suboxone, methadone? Are they taking any other types of medication? One could be like related to like blood pressure or any antipsychotic medications or antidepressants and so forth. And dimension 3 is more just based on their mental health, their thinking, their behaviors, and possible suicidal tendencies or homicidal tendencies. Dimension 4 would be their readiness to change. So that's really focused on their motivation. How bad do they want to change? Do they get good, adequate support regarding their change? Dimension 5 is more relapse prevention. What are their skills and knowledge when it comes to that, like personal relapse prevention plans, aftercare planning? Are they good at identifying their triggers? Are they not good? Or do they have little knowledge, you know? Do they have little experience in doing that? And then finally, dimension 6 is just more the recovery environment. So again, that's more not just like where they're going to live and everything, but who are they going to surround themselves with? Friends, family, their community, do they have a job? Do they plan on getting a job? It also gets into some legal stuff too. Are they on probation? Are they on commitment? Are they working with child protection services at the moment? So then all that is going to play into a huge factor on what level you're going to give them. And the levels can range from like 0 to 4, with 4 being a higher severity and 0 being the more minimum. I don't want to say it's not serious, but again, less to worry about. And I'm not going to get into the rest. That could be possibly for another episode. But so based on those severities is when an assessor will make their decision, for the most part, on what treatment center or what level of care to send them in. So you might like say to yourself, okay, well, outpatient, that's usually the first level of care, right? So you would maybe assume like all the clients that come in have lower levels, right, in all the dimensions. But at the end of the day, that's not always true, and I'll go into more detail with that right now, actually. This has to do more with the assessor, too. They have to really focus on doing a good job when they do these assessments because, again, coordination of care is so important, not just for the facility you're sending the client to, but for the client themselves so they get an adequate level of care. So another thing the assessor needs to be aware of is obviously, yeah, the client could be lying. It happens all the time when you do Rule 25s or any type of assessment too. You know, they may not want to go to a residential treatment center. They might not want to go to intensive outpatient lodging, etc. You know, so they're going to maybe lie about maybe certain traumas they've experienced. They're going to lie about their use, their frequency of use, the amount that they use, you know. So that's why there's this thing called collateral where, long story short, or in layman's terms, is that assessor will attempt to get ROIs from the client so the assessor can contact other people that are part of the client. Like, let's say if they did have child protection, or let's say they did have a probation officer or other people, that assessor could get a hold of those people and ask them, hey, how long has client been using, or how often, or how much, and how many treatment centers have they gone to in the past? So if the assessor feels that the client does not give them adequate information, then they can always go to that collateral. So it would, again, in general, just help them get a much better assessment too. So, because there is nothing worse than sending a client to the wrong facility. It's just really bad on both parties. Now, at the same time, I could be empathetic to the assessor to a point. Again, just throwing out a scenario, you know, that assessor could be given a lot of pressure, you know, to get more clients, let's say, into a treatment center. This is more for, again, the assessor that works for a certain facility, right? And, you know, you take intakes and clients in. And let's say you have a treatment director or an owner breathing down your neck saying, hey, we need more clients in program A, B, C, you know, what's going on, whatever. And, you know, I've seen a lot of assessors, you know, cave in and just assign clients to outpatient treatment where those clients have no business being in outpatient treatment too. So, again, I do have empathy towards that, but at the same time, that's not the right decision, and that's not the right way to go about things. It really isn't, you know, because again, you're just putting the client in more danger, you're putting the staff in more danger, as well as the other clients in that group, you know. One dysfunctional client, or one bad egg, you could say, can ruin a group. Trust me, I've been a part of that situation too, so assessors really need to focus on doing a good job when it comes to that too. So now I feel like it's a good time to get into my perceptions on the pros and cons of outpatient treatment. And again, to all you listeners, if you want a little bit more feedback on this episode or you have questions, again, please comment down below the link or shoot me a message. Because again, these are just going to be my personal thoughts and opinions through my experiences. And where shall I begin on outpatient? All right. Well, first, I am absolutely fine with outpatient if you have the right clients to go with it. And I'm going to explain what that actually means, the right clients. Because you have to take into consideration, okay, why is, let's say, client A there? Are they there from their own free will? Do they actually want to get better? You know, how severe is their drug or alcohol use along with their mental health? Are they on probation? Do they have commitment workers? Do they have CPS workers that they need to follow up on. You know, I have had clients of all kinds regarding those professionals, you know, so that's where you really need to get in depth with that. So if we're going to the aspect of, let's say, they have a probation officer, right? Let's say they just get on probation and they're working with their probation officer and they do the assessment and they get referred to outpatient. Okay, great. What is their actual motivation compared to the severity of their probation? Okay, let's really think about that. Because I have had clients who say, yeah, you know, I want to get better. I want to put in the work. I want to put in the effort. You know, I'm on probation and God, I don't want to go back to jail, you know, because a lot of times clients will be put in situations where it's like, okay, well, you know, you can either have a certain amount of jail time or you could do a 3 to 6 month treatment program, right? And I don't know, I just feel like some of them will just say treatment just not to do any jail time, right? Which makes sense, you know, I have empathy towards that too. But when they do that, they don't at times put in the necessary effort to do well in outpatient treatment. Because you got to put in some effort, right? There is some time you need to put into programming, doing some treatment work and everything. But God, you know, some of the times it's just don't cause issues. You know, it's so like funny when sometimes a client's behavior will get like so negative, and there's this treatment term that we like to use at times. You know, again, it's not really clinical at all, and it's not really the best thing to really think or say. But God, sometimes we'll just be like, dude or man or client, you know, can't you just fake it till you make it? And let me explain that. Through my perception, you know, I kind of grew up with the term fake till you make it when I started as a tech at a treatment center. And that gets into more like they're kind of towards the middle end of their treatment and they're just slacking, they're causing issues, they're not doing well in treatment. And they just have a certain amount of time left and you just think to the client, God, we know you're not trying, we know you don't want to get sober, we know you don't want recovery, but God, can you just fake till you make it, you know, just pretend that you want to get better just to get through the program and on to the next step, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, relapse is a part of recovery, not saying we want that at all, but maybe this is just not the right time in this client's life to be in a treatment center to get recovery, you know, they may still think they don't have a problem, because again, they could just come into treatment saying, oh yeah, I want to get better, you know, tell you all the right things just to make the counselors happy, the staff happy, the probation officer happy, and then they're just skating by, you know, which is, it's fine, it's whatever, you know, whatever floats their boat, you know, as long as they don't affect anyone else's recovery or treatment and they're just doing their own thing, that's fine, you know. And again, a lot of counselors are going to have a different viewpoint than me. That is fine. That is totally fine. This is just my life right now, being a treatment counselor, and this is just how I feel. I also want to bring up another common term. It's called probation is a trap. And what that means is that you're on probation, right? And it's just, let's say, you don't have the capability to complete treatment or make improvements in your life. So they say treatment or probation is a trap because you don't have the ability to finish programming and then you just go back to jail. You know, and again, I have mixed feelings towards that. I understand the concept and it makes a lot of sense. But I don't necessarily think it's a trap, especially, again, geared towards the client who actually does want to make improvements in their lives. They do want to become sober or substance-free or however they think their recovery should be or is. But going back to what I was talking about earlier, you know, if you truly, within yourself, don't want to go to treatment, that is fine, then just serve the jail time or the prison time or however your probation works. And again, this is motivates me so much to get a probation officer on my podcast, and I will very soon, I promise everyone, because they are going to provide a lot of great detail on stuff like this too, so I cannot wait for that. But yeah, getting back to my point, if you just, again, feel like jail is a better option because you just don't want to put up with treatment or counselors, etc., then yes, do your jail time. You'll make your life easier, you'll make the staff's life easier, and like so forth, you know. But if there's a good part of you that feels like, hey, you know what, I think treatment might be good for me, even though, let's say, I may not want to get off drugs or alcohol or whatever, but I think I can get something out of certain programs, by all means, you know, go that route. And going that route means probation is not a trap. So again, to all my listeners, I hope that made sense to everyone. And yeah, so another issue I have come across working outpatient is, as a counselor, what do you do in the moment where, again, you get a client where you just feel like they need to be in a higher level of care, right? Well, you got two different routes, I guess, you can take depending on the clients. So let's say there's option or viewpoint A, where they have a probation officer, right? And that's not really a con or a negative. You just, again, collaborate with the probation officer on the client's behavior. You know, if they're using in treatment, you, again, refer that information to probation. And by the way, to all the future counselors out there or the new ones, most probation officers are going to want like an updated progress note every week along with UAs. Not all of them, but some will just, again, want that type of information. You know, and if you just tell the probation officer, hey, you know, we're having a lot of behavior issues with this particular client, they're using a treatment, we did a behavior contract, you know, it's just not working out. And the probation officer will take the information. And then hopefully you two can work on a referral process to a higher level of care facility. You know, again, frustrating situation, but sometimes it needs to be done. Now, path B, you could say, is let's just say they don't have a probation officer. You know, let's say they thought they're motivated to do treatment, but then found out, hey, you know, I don't want to spend, let's say, 5 to 10 hours a week doing treatment work or going to groups. Or let's say like their girlfriend, wife, husband, family kind of pushed them into treatment or motivated them to go to treatment. Again, that happens all the time. You know, just they want to make their family members happy and they do it, and then they really don't want to do it, and they just, their motivation just changes. It's the way it is, you know. And then you have to have the tough conversation with the client, you know, depending on his behavior or her behavior, it's not working out. And again, those are just really, really tough situations. You know, I've had some rough experiences where, you know, I'd have to discharge a client either due to their behaviors or their constant use. And again, it's never an easy situation. But as counselors, things that we should never do is just kick them out, discharge them, throw them out in the streets and not do anything. You know, as a counselor, you need to do everything in your power to make sure they're taken care of. You know, and that means like referring them to a higher level of care, making sure you get all the paperwork turned in for that treatment center, make sure you do an updated Rule 25, all that stuff so they're not just kicked down the street not doing anything. Now, again, if they don't have any legal issues like keeping them there, then that's up to them if they want to use that information or take advantage of that referral too. So, and yeah, I have personally been a part of some really tough situations, and this one in particular is not really a con on outpatients. It's just a shitty situation where, you know, this one time I was working with a female client and she had no legal issues herself being there. She had child protection services on her. So she's working with a CPS worker, right? And, you know, she had an abusive boyfriend and everything. And It was just a very abusive, toxic relationship. But from the CPS worker's stance is that she either does treatment or she risks losing her children. And throughout her time in treatment, which again was not very long, she was constantly using methamphetamines a lot. And obviously the UAs indicated that. And it was really hard because just looking at her and her situation and knowing very little that I knew, I at least knew she needed mental health services. She needed, you know, in-depth mental health trauma interventions, you know, just right off the bat. But again, it doesn't matter at that point, like, what I think. Obviously, I could, like, advise her to do that through my clinical opinion. Like, hey, you know, I think you'd really benefit from mental health services. But again, she had no, legal issues keeping her there. Her only reason for being there is for her children. And again, she ended up getting discharged because of her drug use. And, you know, me and the CPS worker, we just did everything we could to help her, you know. Me and him actually had a good relationship throughout our time working with her, you know. And that's just, again, good coordination of care. He understood where I was coming from. I understood where he was coming from. He knew her a lot more than I did. And it's just so painful looking at someone's situation and you can't do anything to help them. Because, again, they got to help themselves. And you as an LADC at the moment, you know, I had no control, you know, over that situation, you know. Like, obviously, everybody knew her boyfriend was very toxic and destructive towards her, but, you know, she needs to make that decision to either leave him or whatever. Now, I also feel this is a good time to, again, mention another quick con that I feel outpatients have to go through. And again, think back to what I said about the Rule 25 on the Dimension 6. So again, home environment, what's it like, what's it not like? Who are they engaging with? Who are they talking to? Is their family member or partner toxic, antagonistic? Because all of those variables will highly or could highly increase the chance of stress, anxiety, which eventually leads to relapse. And she had that issue 110%. So in this particular client's case, she would be more likely at a 3 or 4 on the Dimension 6 because of her toxic boyfriend at the time, too. So that's another barrier that outpatient facilities may face working with a client like her or anyone. But again, it was just a very sad case, you know. So you do have those cases where, again, you feel helpless or you feel like you can't help the client enough or in a way that you want to help them, but again, you just need to come to terms and come to peace with that. You can't save everyone or you can't help everyone. You know, because if you go in every day, and that doesn't matter if you're a residential, outpatient, thinking that you could save everyone, and if you don't save everyone, you're a failure, you're going to get burnt out from this field very, very quickly. So as therapists or counselors, you need to come to peace with what you can and cannot control and do the best you can, but at the same time, maintaining appropriate boundaries and good, proper self-care as well. So, all right, now from getting away from the negative stuff, let's get to the positives, or who I feel like can benefit the most, I guess. You know, and again, main issue is that I had was a lot of my clients just needed residential. They needed a higher level of care, for the benefit side of everything, you know, I don't know. I feel like it can maybe benefit someone who thinks they may have a drug or alcohol issue and maybe they'll try outpatient for a little bit, you know, because there's really a couple different ways you could approach outpatient when it comes to like a daily hourly requirement. You know, I ran a group where we met every, Sunday from 8 to 5, I believe, give or take. And those clients just did that one group all week. They would just show up every Sunday from, again, 8 to 5 to get their hours in. Where some clients, there was like a night group. But it wasn't like a 9 to 5 thing. It was like a 2 to 3 day a week thing where they would show up at 5 p.m. and maybe get done around 8 or 9. And they would just do that 2 to 3 times a week, you know. So again, going back to that client who maybe hasn't been using drugs and alcohol for a very long time, or they may feel they may not have a serious issue, but an issue nonetheless. Yeah, I feel like outpatient could possibly benefit those clients. Outpatient is also good for when a client, let's say, completes a like 1 month or like a 3 month residential program, right? Or like an intensive outpatient with lodging. Well, when those clients are done with their programs, they could get referred to an outpatient. That's usually a good step for like an aftercare plan, you know. So for their aftercare plan, they do, let's say, 2 days a week or 3 days a week of outpatient for 3 hours a day. You know, that's just one common example. You know, so again, that would really be beneficial for their aftercare programs, so they can help maintain their sobriety or health goals or mental health goals, or, you know, etc.